Welcome to the Beverage Report. Today, we have with us Professor Oliver Hart from Harvard University. He won the prestigious Nobel Prize in Economics in 2016 for his pioneering work on contract theory. His research centers on the roles that ownership structure and contractual agreements play in the governance of corporations. His recent work focuses on how parties can write better contracts and on corporate social responsibility. A special thank you for this episode goes to Sylvia, Alice Doncor, and the LSE Economics Department. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Oliver Hart. How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you. It's a nice bright day where I am.
Firstly, can you paint us a picture of when you received the phone call informing you that you had won the Nobel Prize? What was it like and what did you feel?
Well, of course, it was pretty thrilling. I it was early, just after 5 a.m. I was awake, but of course, I wasn't, expecting it. I was not. I was hoping, I must say, but anyway, when the phone rang, it was pretty exciting. My wife picked it up and handed the receiver to me. And there was someone with a Swedish accent on the other end of the phone. And, many people say they think it's they're being scammed or something, but I didn't actually think that. But then that was the secretary of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, I think it was. And then, but then they put you through to some people from the committee who you actually know. So that's to reassure you that it is real. Anyway, it was an amazing moment.
Wow, that's really wonderful to hear. So we know a lot about your experience, your expertise, and your accolades. So what do you think makes for an excellent economist?
You know, that's a hard question. I don't think there is a single answer to that, because I think there are lots of, there can be good, people can be good economists in all sorts of ways. But, I think you have to, these days, you need some good technical skills. That's the case whether you are a theorist or applied empirical economists, they need all sorts of statistical skills. But I'm a theorist, so for me a strong math background was very important, but that is just a sort of necessary condition. I think you need to be able to engage with the world in some fashion, which, by the way, I think in my case took quite a long time. So I was quite an ivory tower sort of economic theorist for many years. I was extending the literature in various ways, not thinking that much about whether I was really explaining anything in the world or whether what I was doing could improve matters in the world. That was my primary focus early in my career, was to get stuff published. But over time, as you mature, you age, in my case at least, I eventually, I think, learned a bit more about trying to tackle questions that are important in terms of either explaining the world or, with luck, improving the world. So that became, I think these days my work is much more closely connected to reality than it used to be. So I know it's not really quite the answer to your question, but maybe it's indirectly an answer.
That's wonderful. And going into you've mentioned that, you're a theorist, so we'd love to kind of pick at your brain a little bit and understand what really went on in your mind, for example, when you first came up with the theory of incomplete contracts, which is the work for which you received the Nobel Prize.
Well, that happened in collaboration with one of my long-term co-authors, Sanford Grossman. We were sitting in his office at the University of Chicago in 1983, summer of 1983. And I think we were sort of trying to decide what should we work on next. We didn't, because we'd had a series of things we'd worked on, but you know, what was going to be the next thing? And we fixated on this question, longstanding question in economics, which is the boundaries of the firm. What determines why some transactions take place inside firms and some between independent firms? This is the question that Ronald Coase, of course, very much associated with LSE, he was really the first person to even raise the question, I think, at least in a serious way, in his 1937 article, which was conceived of when he was an undergraduate at LSE, as you may know. It was in, I think, his second or third year as an undergraduate, which seems astonishing. It took him a while to actually develop the idea. He went to the United States for a year, or at least part of a year. Anyway, a few years later, he actually completed the paper. Okay, so that was so he raised the question, then a number of other people worked on it. But we, Sandy and I, thought, well, you know, maybe this would be a good thing for two theorists to work on, because the people who had worked in it had not really been theorists of the kind we were, that is, mathematically well-trained and so on. So we thought a new approach would be good, and that led us to Incomplete Contracts, because basically what we decided, and I think this was correct, is that the only time it really makes a difference whether I am making something inside my firm, so that is my employees are producing it, versus I've outsourced that operation to a separate firm and I have a contract with them. The only time those two situations are different is, it has to be because, let's go back to the case where I outsource it. The contract I write with the outsourcer is incomplete. It has something left out of it. If there was nothing left out, then in fact, the two situations would be equivalent, because you would have a complete contract with an independent firm on the one hand, if you were outsourced. If you do it inside the firm, you would have complete employment contracts with your employees. What do I mean by a complete contract? That would be a contract which specifies everything that's meant to happen in all circumstances. So it would be a contingent contract. It would say, well, you know, if there's a financial crisis, we will, you know, change the quantity we're trading, the price, then maybe the nature of the good, or if there's a pandemic, we'll do this. It would be all the contingencies would be written into the contract, and then we just wait and see what happens, and then we would look at the contract, and the contract would say exactly what we're meant to do in that situation. Okay, in reality, contracts are not complete in that way. They have gaps, and that's when the two situations, the outsourcing one versus doing it in-house, that's when they become different. Because a key question, what we focused on was, given that a contract is incomplete, that it doesn't specify everything, then who gets to decide on the things that are missing? And that led us to a theory of ownership and firm boundaries. So that's basically how it happened.
Wonderful. So just for our listeners, could you describe some of your findings, and specifically, like you mentioned, the question of who gains the decision right?
This is interesting, at least for me. Not sure for, but because my thinking on this has really evolved, actually, even since the prize, because, and I'll explain why that is, but certainly my early work with Grossman, and then later with John Moore, who is still at LSE. Have you had any courses from him?
Not yet, unfortunately.
We focused on the following idea, that if a contract is incomplete, then that gives, let's go back to this example. I've outsourced some service that I need to you, and we have a contract, but it's incomplete. That gives you, we argued, the opportunity to hold me up. That is to say, when something happens that we didn't anticipate, and let's say I need either more of the service or a different service, so I have to come back and renegotiate the contract with you. And you could play hardball and say, okay, yes, I'll supply the new service, but I'm going to, you know, you're going to have to really pay for it a lot, because you have a lot of bargaining power, because I'm very reliant on you at this stage. We started off this relationship sometime in the past. I become dependent on you. And so you could be very extortionary. One way I can guard against that is if I did the if I had the operation in-house. Why would that change things? Well, what changes is that it gives me control over the non-human assets in the relationship. So to use an example, which I probably use too much, imagine I'm a power plant and you're a coal mine, and I'm getting coal from you to burn to make electricity, and now I need a different kind of coal from you. So in the case where you're an independent coal mine, as I was saying, you have a lot of leverage. You could charge me a lot for the new coal. But if you're an employee of mine instead, so if I kept the operations in-house, what would that mean in this case? It would mean that I own the coal mine, and you simply work in the coal mine for me as the owner. So now, if you tried to, I mean, your ability to hold me up is much reduced, maybe non-existent, because, you know, if you try to say, yes, I will supply the new coal, but only if you pay me a much higher wage, I could always say, well, reader, I don't really need you. I'll get rid of you, I'll fire you and replace you with somebody else who's going to be more compliant. That's something it's much harder to do if you're if you are the owner manager of the coal mine, because I can't easily find another coal mine, but I might be able to find another person, another manager. Okay, so what we argue then is that the benefit of, you know, if I own the coal mine, I can I'm not worried about being held up. On the other hand, you as the manager of the coal mine are much more vulnerable if you're an employee than if you are an independent, you know, if it's your mine. Why? Well, now, because precisely, you know, if you say, if you had a great idea about how to operate the mine more efficiently, if you owned the mine, you could implement that idea without my permission and get the benefits from it. But if you work for me, if you're merely a manager, not an owner, then, you know, I might say, well, that's a great idea, but I don't need you to implement it. And I could, you know, because I have the ability to hire someone else to implement the idea, I can deprive you of the benefits of having the idea. So that's going to be make you less inclined to have ideas in the first place, because you know you're not going to get the full return from them. So that leads to a trade-off that if I own the mine, I'm going to be more willing to invest in the relationship because I'm not worried about you taking advantage of me. But on the other hand, you're going to be more worried about me taking advantage of you. So it so my investment, my willingness to invest goes up if I acquire the coal mine, but your willingness as a manager to have ideas goes down. And so it all depends on whose contribution is more important, whose investment is more important. So that was what the initial theory was about. However, so this is a very long answer to your question, but I can come to either now or later on as to how, why my thinking and how my thinking has evolved. I don't know. You decide.
Absolutely. I would love to hear it.
All right. I continue. Okay. So here's a little segue into the next thing. One of the great things that actually happened to me as a result of winning the prize. And this was serendipity, completely fortuitous. When I went to Stockholm for the Nobel Week, which is a quite remarkable thing, there's nothing like it, and it's extremely intense. It's just non-stop activities, most of which are incredibly enjoyable, if not all. But one of the things that happens during this week, at the end of which you get the prize, is that you get a lot of invitations, and some of them are official ones. Obviously, you do those, but then you also get some sort of ones from various entities in Stockholm want you to come and talk to them and so on. And most of those, you don't have time to do or you don't want to do. But one of them that looked interesting to me was from a law firm. And I thought, lawyers, they work on contracts, so it might be good to talk to them. So anyway, I accepted that one. And the person who invited me, whose name is David Friedlinger, he and I really hit it off. And he was particularly taken with my more recent work. So this is back in 2016. I had started on a new line of work on incomplete contracts, which was published, a paper in 2008 with John Moore, called Contracts as Reference Points. So this was introducing some behavioral elements into contract theory. And anyway, it wasn't, so I talked a little bit about that at this law firm, and that really resonated with him. And anyway, to cut a long story short, we started working together, and we've written one paper that was published in the Harvard Business Review, along with another co-author, Kate Vitasek, and we have so that was a chattier paper. We have a more analytical paper, which we finally, just as of yesterday, heard was accepted for publication in the Journal of Law, Economics and Organization, after being rejected, by the way, by a couple of top tier journals, but eventually it will see the light of day. And in fact, the Journal of Law, Economics and Organization provided much more useful referee reports on this paper, which really allowed us to improve the paper. Anyway, the thing about this paper, so this is really rather different from my earlier work, because the view we take in this paper, and as I say, it sort of follows on from this contracts as reference point idea. It's saying that, hold up behavior, the kind of thing I was talking about earlier, it's certainly a possibility, but it's rather extreme. It's hold up behavior, just to describe it again, it's like I make an investment I become locked into you, I site my power plant next to you, and then you use every opportunity of contractual incompleteness to take advantage of me and expropriate my investment to the point where I may regret ever having entered the relationship. That's that's hold up behavior. And, I was saying people could buy and sell assets in order to mitigate that. But I think that kind of behavior is actually rather extreme, and most business people do not behave that way. Some may. I mean, I could mention, I think if I had a contractual relationship with Donald Trump, I would be concerned about hold up behavior, because he has a tradition of stiffing his creditors and lots of people. And by the way, Elon Musk is another person who seems to be capable of this. But I think these may be quite extreme players. And most business people are not as opportunistic as that. And so in my more recent work, I've emphasized more that the problems of contractual incompleteness are that it's not that I'm out to get you or you're out to get me. It's more that when something happens outside the contract, we may not agree on what a reasonable way forward is. And to the extent, I think, let's say you're supplying me with, I need a change of input or something like that. I might think that the price should change this way, and you might, you might think you deserve a bit more. We might compromise on something, but sometimes that's going to leave some bad feeling because I don't think the outcome was reasonable, or you don't think it's reasonable. Maybe neither of us thinks it's reasonable because we have different views about what is reasonable. That can sour the relationship going forward and make us less cooperative. So it's not, you know, extreme opportunism. It's more just people looking at the situation in different ways. And if you think of it that way, then what you would really like to try to do is to align people's views. So make sure that people are on the same page when unexpected things happen, remain on the same page. And this is what the point of our new paper is, the one that was just accepted, which is called Overcoming Contractual Incompleteness, the Role of Guiding Principles. So the basic idea is that what the parties, when the parties start their relationship, they're going to have a contract, but they realize that this contract is incomplete. And so what they do is they agree on some guiding principles they're going to use when something happens that was not in the contract. And the guiding principles, so here, this is where it was a kind of marriage between my theory and David Friedlinger's practical experience, because he'd actually been advising his clients to use the approach I'm about to describe with guiding principles. So they have six guiding principles they use, which are equity, loyalty, reciprocity, autonomy, honesty, and integrity. So what our most recent paper shows, and you can find it on my website, it sort of provides a model for how this can work. So basically the idea is that these guiding principles can help us to stay on the same page. So if I've agreed, for example, to be loyal, if we both agreed, then when something comes up unexpected, I've sort of agreed not just to look at what should happen from my point of view, but I've agreed to also look at it from your point of view. That's, I think, in a nutshell, what these guiding principles are about. That's something, by the way, people are going to be inclined to do in any relationship. They're not going to be completely selfish. But these guiding principles can sort of build on this sort of other-centeredness that we all have and amplify it to the point where we're going to, let's say, if there's a pandemic and we have to respond to this unprecedented situation, these guiding principles are going to help us to achieve an outcome that both of us think is reasonable, and therefore avoid bad feelings, as I was saying, that might sour the relationship. So that's what I'm working on now, and I think that is actually much closer to the truth than the hold-up behavior that I used to think was centrally important.
Wonderful. And it's really interesting that you mentioned the guiding principles, because I think that makes contract theory encompass a lot more different industries and different areas. So this is more of an extreme question. Do you think that there is an industry which you believe that cannot or will not be able to implement contract theory, even with the guiding principles, as you mentioned?
Not really, actually. I mean, I think in principle, the guiding principles can work in all situations. I don't think they're always going to be necessary or desirable, because the way this approach works is it's not just a matter of, so when you write the contract, you agree to these guiding principles and they're part of the contract. They're actually written down and everything. You don't just say we will be loyal, we will be equitable, etc. The parties have to discuss this at some length, what they mean by this, and they're also talking about what each is expecting to get out of the relationship, and all sorts of things like that. Which all of this is quite time consuming. So as we make clear in our work, it's not for everybody, because in some situations you don't need all this machinery. A standard contract is going to work fine because, you know, particularly if it's a sort of shorter term relationship, then, you know, the chance of unexpected things is quite low. And so you can just write a standard, let's call it a transactional contract. But in longer term, more complicated relationships, I think it's worth incurring the extra cost of incorporating these guiding principles. I don't think, though, it depends on the industry. It might depend on the kind of person, you know, as I was saying, if you, for whatever reason, are dealing with somebody who you think it can be extremely opportunistic because that's just in their nature, then it may not, you know, maybe you have to really worry about hold up and sort of use the older approach. But putting aside differences in personalities, I don't particularly see that it's industry specific. Certainly, I think my co-author, Friedlinger, who is the guy who actually puts this into practice, he thinks it has very wide applicability, and including, by the way, even, so people often say, well, what about if you're contracting with somebody in a completely, in a different country, with a different legal tradition or something, can you really use this stuff? His answer would be, yes, you can, because the guiding principles I mentioned are basically based on norms that we're all familiar with. In other words, equity and loyalty or honesty and stuff. These are things that everybody knows about. So the way we think of incorporating the guiding principles into the contract, it's more a matter of activating norms that are already in people's brains. And that's true whether, you know, you're talking about somebody in the United States or the United Kingdom or France or India or China. It doesn't matter. The norms are kind of universal. So that's why he thinks it can be used in a lot of situations.
I see. That makes a lot of sense. And in the spirit of talking about the evolution of the theory, do you think that artificial intelligence and specifically the wealth of information that you can gather using AI can it help predict agent behavior and thereby maybe ease the issue of uncertain contingencies in healthcare or insurance?
Yes, I mean, I say yes, but I think my answer is maybe no. I'm not quite sure. I mean, your question makes me think of things like blockchain. I don't know whether that's what you have in mind, but people often ask me about smart contracts. One of the things that is advertised as a payoff from blockchain, that you could automate things. So it may not be what you were thinking. I don't know whether AI is that, but I'll respond to the thing I know, the blockchain question or smart contracts, because I'm often asked about that. I'm never really sure about, I, frankly, Bitcoin and blockchain, even though I still have difficulty understanding them. And of course now, you know, people say, oh, with this FTX collapse, is this the end of Bitcoin? Is it the end of these things? You know, it probably isn't. But to the extent I understand the stuff at all, I would say that, yes, there are some things where automation via blockchain could help to solve some problems. But I think we're talking about very transactional situations, not relationships. So I'm the kind of thing I'm interested in, and it's because of, you know, it came from this make or buy or boundaries, the firm decision. When you outsource something versus keeping it in-house, we're not talking about a short run transaction. We're talking about something that's going to extend for, you know, years. And so we're talking about relationships. And that's why I focused on the importance of keeping the contracting parties on the same page so that they don't get annoyed with each other. I don't think AI or blockchain is going to solve that problem. Unless, you know, could I imagine a world where decisions are, you know, some when we have a disagreement, a computer makes the decision. Well, maybe, but that's a bit like bringing in an arbitrator. And, you know, some people say, well, one of the benefits of arbitration is some outsider is making the decision, and then maybe I don't blame you for what happened. But I'm not sure arbitration is nearly as good as guiding principles, because arbitration, you know, I may still, and I think there's evidence on this, I may still, you know, to the extent I feel that the decision was wrong, I'm still going to be angry. I may not be angry at you, but I'm going to be angry at somebody, and I may take it out on you because I can't take it out on the arbitrator. So I think it's much better if you and I can just, as they say, always arrange things so that the outcomes seem reasonable to both of us. And I think this is about personal relationships and not about AI.
True. I think that is something that AI would probably never be able to simulate. But before we switch gears to some of your other work, I'd love to know, what future research would you like to see carried out in the field of contract theory?
I would like to see more people working on the stuff that I've just described, not because I think it's the only way forward, but I think it is at least an interesting way forward. And I think, so let me divide up contract theory into two parts. So if you look at the work for which the prize was awarded in 2016, you know, I was one of the lucky winners, but the other one was Bengt Holmström, a very good friend of mine, and he got it for work on principal agent theory. So, you know, he was principal agent theory, I was in complete contracts. I think his work is much more, what he did is much more settled. You know, he did some great work, and I don't think anybody questions it as a foundation for principal agent theory. Although there are people who try to extend the principal agent theory, you know, and some of it's good and all that, but I think the basic elements are out there already. So that, of course, there's always empirical work to be done in that area, but I'm not sure that there's any great theory to be done. I think it's been done. Now, when it comes to incomplete contracts, as my evolution sort of suggests, I think there are many more open questions. I don't think we've really got to the bottom of the make or buy decision, I think, after all this time. And so, you know, it's much more unsettled. And so I would like to see people continue to work on incomplete contracts. But what I think is, as certainly based on my own experience, I don't think it's a matter anymore of just writing down mathematically clever models, because as I've described my own work and the evolution, you know, I was lucky enough to team up with a practitioner. You know, the paper we've written, if you look at it, I mean, there's nothing analytically very clever about it. And that's probably why we had trouble getting it into top journals, because they're always, that's what they're looking for. And so, but I think the truth is not to be found there. It's to be found in some combination of a bit of theory, that's certainly very important, together with some actual knowledge of the world, which in my case came from teaming up with a practitioner. It's not so easy for people to do that, but I think that is the future. And I think there's you know, a lot to be done.
It's really fascinating to see that this collaboration was able to bring so much more to the theory.
Well, we'll see. I think it did, but you know, whether the readers will, you know.
Thank you for listening. That is all for this episode. Tune in to our next one as we continue our discussion with Professor Hart, talking about his recent engagements and work on corporate social responsibility.